Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
When plates collide, Chile fights lawlessness in hard-hit cities.
I would say an initiative that people need to assure food, water, electricity, and of course, public order.
Chilean President Michelle Bachelet is trying to keep the lid on some devastated coastal communities in Chile. The U.S. State Department says the nation should be confident about its future.
Chile is a highly capable, advancing country, and that's one of the reasons why there's such a contrast in the response to Haiti and the response to Chile. It's a government that is running a budget surplus.
Geology and politics in the Western Hemisphere, a conversation with U.S. State Department spokesman P.J. Crowley. On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning, everyone. It's Wednesday, March 3rd, and The Takeaway is how these two disasters in the Western Hemisphere have created a snapshot of the U.S. relationship with both the countries of Haiti and Chile.
And a snapshot of what prepared really means in real terms, in human terms. Let's get right to the top stories you're following this morning. President Obama will explain his final plan to overhaul the healthcare system today. He's expected to embrace a few Republican ideas, while at the same time urging Democrats to use a budget process called reconciliation to force a majority rules vote. The Republican answer, Senator Jed Gregg, tells The Takeaway.
Everybody should have problems with that bill because it's such an atrocity. It's like a giant asteroid headed at Earth.
The Senate was able to agree long enough to pass an extension of jobless benefits last night. It had been held up by Senator Jim Bunning. President Obama has already signed it.
To Chile now, where we've been reporting the death toll is rising, along with a sense of despair in the nation. Relief supplies finally arrived, and many residents are furious with the slow government response time. We were joined earlier by Valeria Perasso, a reporter for our partner in the BBC. She joined us from Chile, where she spent a considerable amount of time in Concepcion, near the epicenter of the quake. We began by asking her how severely the government is imposing curfews.
Well, the military forces are determined to get the curfew working, get it in place as hard as they can, because that's the only way they think they could control the mounting rise of violence, looting, and intentional fires that occurred in this city in the days after the earthquake. So yesterday night at 6 p.m., 2 hours before the night before, they decided to stop people, to tell them to go inside their houses and get the curfew in place, while military trucks were patrolling the city and checking everyone's papers to see if they had permission to stay out.
More with the BBC's Valeria Perasso in Concepcion, Chile, in just a moment.
Here at home, Texas Governor Rick Perry handily defeated Senator Kay Bailey Hutchison in the Republican gubernatorial primary. Perry took 51% of the vote, avoiding a runoff. He'll face former Houston Mayor Bill White in November.
And in the Get This department, the FAA is apparently investigating how a child was allowed to direct air traffic at New York's JFK Airport, one of the busiest in the nation. Here's the sound, the voice of this kid clearing runway traffic.
JetBlue 171, clear for takeoff.
Clear for takeoff, JetBlue 171.
JetBlue 171, contact departure.
Over to departure, JetBlue 171, awesome job.
Now, it's hard not to be sympathetic to take your children to work day, but nevertheless,
well,
investigators say the child was brought to the tower by its parent, who is a controller, on February 17th.
Which you just heard there. He did an awesome job.
Did an awesome job. The controller and the controller's supervisor have been fired. Asian markets are mixed. European indices are down. Futures are down. The Dow gets underway at 10,405. The S&P opens at 1,118, and the NASDAQ opens at 2,280. Coming up, we're going to talk about food every Wednesday. It's our food segment, Sugar Proliferating in Our Diet, how to keep foods from getting sweeter. That's later in the hour.
And so maybe the message to the world would be less sugar, but our partner, the BBC, is hosting a competition to give people a chance to give a message out to the world, my world. And we're going to talk about this later this morning. You can also get details of this project on our website, but we want you to tell us, what do you want other people to know about you? How do you see the world? Let us know at 8778-MY-TAKE or go to the website, thetakeaway.org. More on U.S. plans to help Chile in a moment.
Good morning, everyone. Since last Saturday, when an 8.8 magnitude earthquake struck Chile, the nation's disaster response network, its military and police force have all been tested in some of the hardest hit areas where there have been reports of curfews, looting, and vigilantes protecting their threatened property. At the same time, aid has been arriving from around the world. Yesterday, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton arrived in the Chilean capital, Santiago, promising aid. And in a few moments, we'll speak with the State Department spokesman P.J. Crowley about how the earthquake may have the potential to affect the U.S.-Chile relationship. But first, let's continue our conversation with Valeria Perasso. She's a reporter for our partner, the BBC, and she joined us earlier from Concepcion, one of the cities with the most damage. And we began talking about the condition generally of the people in Concepcion.
The city still lacks electricity and running water in most of its buildings, and there are lots of people camping on the streets, people who have either lost their houses or decided to leave and stay in open spaces, camping there in tents because they are too scared to go back. Their houses show cracks, they are heavily deteriorated, and they don't want to risk being there in case an aftershock happens. So the city is full of people during the day, and then at 6 o'clock, it becomes a ghost town, literally. Everyone goes in, the curfew is in place, and only police cars and army patrols are around the streets.
Valeria Perasso, there have been reports of successes in the rescue efforts in individual buildings. Have you managed to witness people being pulled from the rubble, even given the terrible situation there?
Yeah, there's a key building, a 15-story apartment block, what used to be a 15-story apartment block, who has been torn apart and is literally standing in two pieces at the moment in the upper part of Concepcion. There were teams of at least 100 workers trying to get belongings of the people from under the rubble while they were looking for victims still trapped there. And I spoke to one of the coordinators of the security operation, and he told me that he managed to get a man the first day of the earthquake and then went back to rescue his wife and his children. Unfortunately, the man is alive, the children and the wife no longer are. But everything is very emotional. These people have had very few hours sleep and they work against the clock, literally nonstop, trying to get whatever is left there because in 72 hours, what remains of the building needs to be pulled down.
Valeria Perasso, is the presence of the military a comfort to the people in Concepcion, or are they worried that this is a sign of a crackdown?
No, everyone seems to be quite relieved to see the military officials around the city because the previous days the looting and the violence was really, really mounting. So everyone I spoke to was preferred to have this curfew and stay inside and make sure that their belongings and their lives were safe. Even the security workers said that they had been robbed. Their equipment, their boots had been stolen by these people. So, in a way, seeing this city heavily militarized is a relief for everyone here.
It's Valeria Perasso, a reporter for our partner, the BBC. She joined us earlier from some of the hardest hit areas in Chile near Concepcion. We also spoke earlier with P.J. Crowley, spokesman for the U.S. State Department, and we asked him how worried the U.S. is over the use of military forces by the Chilean government in these affected areas.
Well, I don't think we're worried at all. Chile is a highly capable, advancing country, and that's one of the reasons why there's such a contrast in the response to Haiti and the response to Chile. Chile has considerable capabilities, they have experience with earthquakes, and the aid that they're requesting from the national community, including the United States, is very specific, very targeted. But they have a capable military, obviously a difficult history with that military, but civilian leadership is very sound. They're about to go through the inauguration of a new president. So this earthquake happens at a difficult time politically, but no one is questioning the control of the Chilean government over Chile.
Indeed. P.J. Crowley, the spokesman for the State Department, is with us. Let's listen to your boss, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, who visited Santiago yesterday.
The United States is ready to respond to the requests that the government of Chile has made so that we can provide not only solidarity, but specific supplies.
Now, we hear the Secretary of State mentioning specific supplies. You used the word specific, it seemed, very deliberately a moment ago. How sensitive is the Chilean government, do you think, to this issue of international aid? The U.S. ambassador to Chile spoke yesterday that there was some concern over possibly Chile being humiliated in the same way that Hugo Chavez offering aid after Katrina to the U.S. was attempting to humiliate the United States. Not that anyone's trying to do that to Chile.
Well, I mean, one can look back to our own experience in New Orleans. There was some foreign assistance, but for the most part, we had the ability within our own country to respond to New Orleans. And likewise, you know, Chile has a great deal of experience with earthquakes. They had a devastating earthquake in 1960, and from that, they've built up their capabilities. They have very strong building codes. So, you know, whereas we talked about, you know, hundreds of thousands of deaths in Haiti, you're talking about several hundred deaths in Chile. But the things that they're looking at, bridges have been affected, so they're looking for portable bridges. As your previous reporter was talking about, you know, absence of water and electricity, so generators, water purification equipment, a field hospital. The secretary brought satellite phones with her. So they're very specific capabilities that help Chile with its response. But Chile itself, it's a government that is running a budget surplus. So there are resources within Chile to respond to this.
All right. Finally, in the less than a minute before we go, P.J. Crowley, we've seen two examples of geology in the Western Hemisphere possibly strengthening the relationship between the U.S. and two important nations, Haiti and Chile. Do you see it that way?
Well, we already have a strong relationship with Chile. It will grow from this. And with Haiti, obviously, there's an important donor conference coming up at the end of March. Haiti's going to need a lot of help for a long time.
That was P.J. Crowley, spokesman for the U.S. State Department, talking about the U.S. aid effort, the U.S. response to the earthquake in Chile, and the situation in Haiti. As we mentioned, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton arrived in Santiago yesterday with the beginnings of the aid effort, which is likely to continue.
The conversation continues at thetakeaway.org. Leave a comment now.
And at 15 minutes after the hour, let's check in on some stories we're following.
Today at the White House, the president will present his revised health care proposals that'll include a handful of suggestions from the GOP. But Republicans say the changes don't mean they'll vote for the bill. Still, the president hopes the changes will help sway Democrats who were on the fence. In Texas, incumbent Rick Perry defeated Senator Kay Bailey Hutchinson in a tough primary fight to become the Republican Party's nominee for governor. Perry says his conservative principles will help him win again in November.
I'm going to work to unite the Republican team to win in November by carrying the torch of limited government, unlimited opportunity, and good jobs for Texas.
Bill White, the former mayor of Houston, will represent the Democrats in the November race.
Also yesterday, a Senate vote to extend unemployment benefits for the jobless.
The ayes are 78, the nays are 19. The bill is passed.
Senator Kay Hagan there announcing the results of the vote. The president signed the bill last night. It also includes a measure to send 2,000 furloughed transportation workers back to work today. Finally, for the first time ever, a nominee has been banned from attending the Oscars. The Academy says a producer on the movie The Hurt Locker will not be allowed to attend. That's because he sent an email urging judges to vote against what he called the $500 million film for Best Picture. The Academy says the comment was a clear reference to Avatar and is in violation of an Academy ban on creating a negative impression of a rival nominee. Imagine backstabbing in Hollywood. That's bizarre. Look at some of the stories we're watching this morning. Coming up, what's in a number? We talked yesterday about all the numbers in the news. Your voices in just a moment.
Hey, you want that to go?
Now for some takeouts on stories you're following this week. Well, unless you're a baseball fan, you may not have been aware of the name Jim Bunning before this week, but a lot of people now know who the Kentucky Republican senator is. That's because Jim Bunning was the lone man to filibuster jobless benefits, payments for doctors, highway construction, small business loans, and a whole host of other programs.
The question is whether or not we as a Senate and we as a government are going to pay for what we spend.
But the senator relented last night. Joining us now is Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick. Good morning, Todd.
Hi, good morning, Celeste.
So Jim Bunning changed his mind. Too much pressure?
Well, it became clear after a couple of days of this that while Republicans do like the idea of challenging Democrats to pay for things for this $10 billion, having that challenge now in a hurting economy when people are hurting, losing their unemployment benefits, COBRA health benefits, maybe not being able to go to work on a highway project that they got a job on, just probably wasn't good politics. It was unclear when Jim Bunning would relent, but he finally did. They had a vote and the extension passed last night.
It couldn't have helped when they had people all over the news saying, I'm unemployed and I just lost my benefits because of Jim Bunning.
It couldn't have helped, and it didn't help.
That's right. So we're getting a lot of movement from the White House on health care today, and we're hearing that the president actually wrote a letter to congressional leaders yesterday. He said that after the summit, he's decided to make four specific concessions to the Republicans on health care. What are these four concessions he's talking about?
That's right, but I'm going to back you off of that just a little bit. Celeste, that word concessions makes it seem like the president is going a long way to compromise. And this letter doesn't really reflect that. Now, it is an outreach to Republicans. The president's going to make a speech today outlining these 4 points. The president says he's willing to go further on curbing waste and fraud in the health care system. And Republicans will like that a little bit, but that's already in the bill. The president says he's willing to have some more experimentation in the states to curb lawsuits against doctors. That might be a bit of a concession, but there was already some nods in the bill towards experimenting with malpractice lawsuits. There was boosting Medicaid. Medicaid is the health care program for the poor. There's boosting Medicaid payments for doctors. President's willing to do that. And including health savings accounts. This is a concession. Health savings accounts are tax-free accounts. Republicans love them because they lower taxes. It's in a way sort of a voucher system for health care in a way. Democrats are not fond of this program, but the president said he's willing to include it. That's a concession. So then you wonder, are Republicans impressed with this outreach from the president? Listen to Republican leader Mitch McConnell yesterday after he read the letter.
There's a suggestion that we might have a few items inadequately addressed in a 2,700-page bill.
Not too impressed.
Not too impressed. So we also heard Nancy Pelosi saying she wished the president well with this. Does that mean that Democrats are skeptical of the president's attempt to reach out across the aisle?
Absolutely. We wish the president well getting bipartisanship, but Democrats feel they've had none so far. So then the plan is reconciliation, as we've talked about, which is not a bipartisan approach at all.
Lastly, let's talk about New York Congressman Charlie Rangel. He is currently the chairman for the Ways and Means Committee, but he's being charged with ethics violations, and the Democrats were hoping he would step down from his chairmanship, but he's refused to do so.
And we'll see if by the end of the day or the end of the week, Charlie Rangel is still chairman. He went into a meeting with Nancy Pelosi last night, and rumors were swirling around the Hill that Charlie Rangel was done as chairman. But when he came out of that meeting, he said, "You bet your life I'm still chairman." Republicans are going to force a vote on this, and we'll see how many Democrats want to stand by Rangel to keep him in control of one of the most powerful committees in Congress going into an election where a lot of them are going to be vulnerable. So by the end of the week, we'll see if Mr. Rangel is still in charge.
Thanks, Todd. Todd Zwillick is the Takeaway's Washington correspondent.
For our last takeout, a conversation that we seeded yesterday adds your voices. We talked, first of all, about trying to make sense of the big and small numbers in our world, from that 60-vote majority needed in Congress to the 8.8 Chilean earthquake, the magnitude, to the recent mark of 1,000 American soldiers dying in Operation Enduring Freedom.
We as humans, every single day, we hear about Congress passing, you know, trillion-dollar budgets. We hear all these numbers every single day. So numbers don't mean a whole lot until you actually can associate a body with that number.
You probably remember the voice of Pat Merrick there, mother of one of those 1,000 fallen soldiers. You can listen back to that interview at our website, thetakeaway.org. But we've heard from you. How do you put numbers like 1,000, 60, or 8.8 in context?
I'm calling from Boca Raton, Florida. My name is Sam. With the superlatives that are used by the media, I think without using numbers, you have no real comprehension as to what the disaster or what the conditions might be. On the other hand, I don't believe that the human mind is capable of just dealing with a number. For example, in the Holocaust, whether you're dealing with 1,000 deaths or 100,000 deaths or 1,000,000 deaths, the numbers become incomprehensible.
And Patricia in New York has an interesting point. She emails us how she doesn't like that the media uses numbers in headlines that say at least this many killed. Patricia writes, I understand this is shorthand to express the as yet uncounted fatalities, but implied in the use of the words at least, there seems to me is a hope that the number will be larger. Whatever happened to the more sober and more respectful known dead?
Our news writers actually started using it this morning. I think they took Patricia's advice there. Evelyn writes us, I've lived near the Washington coast for over 25 years, and the numbers I've never gotten used to are earthquake levels. How close are we to the big one? Right up there on my list is the attendant tsunami potential, possible wave heights, how far inland it could come, etc. I don't have a feeling the West Coast states are prepared at all for either of these kinds of disasters, let alone the small, economically challenged communities in which I've lived. Local news reports following disasters like Haiti and Chile confirm that opinion.
And we're going to leave you with some philosophy from David in Nashua, New Hampshire. He sends us a quote from Alexis de Tocqueville. When statistics are not based upon computations that are strictly accurate, they mislead instead of guiding aright. The mind is easily imposed upon by the affectation of exactitude, which marks even the misstatement of statistics and adopts with confidence the errors which are appareled in the forms of mathematical truth.
You can challenge our affectations of exactitude by calling us at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can reach us at thetakeaway.org, or you can offer your own affectations of exactitude. You know how to reach us.
Coming up, a school district in North Carolina tried busing students in order to increase diversity. It doesn't look like that has helped, so they're going to end busing, or try to. We're going to talk about that in just a few minutes. First, here's some of the news stories you're following at 30 minutes after the hour. This is the sound of amateur video taken in a nightclub in Santiago, Chile, when the earthquake struck last weekend. Four days after the country was hit by its strongest earthquake in 50 years, the death toll now stands at nearly 800, and many residents are upset with the government's slow response time. Earlier this hour, the State Department spokesman P.J. Crowley told us what Chile is asking for from the U.S. in terms of aid.
The things that they're looking at, bridges have been affected, so they're looking for portable bridges. You know, absence of water, electricity, so generators, water purification equipment, a field hospital.
There are no plans to send U.S. troops to the region. You can hear that full interview at our website, thetakeaway.org.
The Supreme Court has refused to block Washington, D.C.'s gay marriage law, and yesterday that freed the city to issue its first marriage licenses to same-sex couples starting today. The FAA, meanwhile, is investigating how a child was allowed to direct air traffic at New York's JFK Airport, one of the busiest in the nation. Here's the voice of the child directing air traffic.
Contact departure, adios.
Contact departure, Aeromexico 403, adios.
Investigators say the child was brought to the tower by his parent, who is a controller, on February 17th. The controller and the controller's supervisor have been fired. Finally, an interesting anniversary to tell you about. 65 years ago today, American Marines stormed the beaches of Iwo Jima, launching one of the fiercest battles of World War II. Nearly 7,000 U.S. lives were lost. Over 20,000 Japanese were killed. John Huffines, who fought at Iwo Jima, tells CBS News he was terrified as he approached the island.
We got a little closer, and I saw that those shells were hitting in the water and hitting on the beach, and my attitude changed, and I was pretty scared.
Battle of Iwo Jima, 65 years ago today. In the markets, European indices down, futures down. The Dow gets underway at 10,405 in an hour. The S&P opens at 1,118, and the Nasdaq at 2,280. Those are some of the stories that we're following this morning.
So Wake County, North Carolina has been the center of a racial, economic, some class issues that started with school busing. They had made attempts to integrate their school system. The Wake County School adopted a policy in 2000 in which they bused students based on their socioeconomic backgrounds. That's because it's unconstitutional at this point to bus students based on their racial backgrounds. So in order to achieve diversity, they started moving kids from poor neighborhoods into wealthier neighborhoods to go to school and vice versa. But last night, the school board that governs the district voted 5-4 to abandon the busing policy. Joining us now is Dave DeWitt. He's the education reporter for WUNC North Carolina Public Radio. He's been covering this school busing issue for the past 4 years, and he was there at last night's school board meeting. Good morning, Dave.
Good morning.
So here's the thing. When school busing programs were instituted, they were trying to address the problem of racial segregation in our schools. It's been decades since that happened. Since then, since the 1980s especially, school districts have been phasing out these busing programs. So the question for me is not why the Wake County is trying to get rid of their school busing programs, but how come Wake County still has the school busing program?
Well, Wake County, like many school districts in the South in particular, did use race as a factor in determining where students went to school. But in 2000, what it did, instead of abandoning the policy altogether, like many school districts, it switched to using socioeconomic background to bus students. And it was the first large school district in the country to do so, and it's still the largest school district in the country to do so. They did that because the school board at the time really wanted to keep diversity in the schools and wanted to deal with some of the high poverty concentrated areas that in the city of Raleigh, like many cities across the country, deal with. And so this policy's been in place for about 10 years. It's weathered some political storms and some efforts to undo it in the past, and now an effort to get that policy changed succeeded last night, as you mentioned.
But it's been very controversial. However, did it address segregation? Did you get a bigger mix of diverse students at the schools because of busing?
Well, the policy said that no school should have more than 40% low-income students. And over the years, as growth really exploded in this area here in Wake County and Raleigh, that threshold was not met in many of the schools. But certainly some, probably a dozen or more, weren't able to keep that threshold. So they were struggling to adhere to the policy itself. And as you said, there have been a lot of challenges to that policy. Whether it achieved raising the academic performance of low-income students was really a mixed bag, and a lot of folks used educational statistics on either side. Folks who disagreed with the policy cited that the high dropout rate, 54% graduation rate of low-income students, was proof that the policy wasn't working in the first place.
All right, let's go now to Patrice Lee. She's the mother of five, but she's also the director of Wake Cares. It's a parent advocacy group that opposes school redistricting plans and strongly opposes the busing program. Right, Patrice?
That's correct. I really do. Initially, when Wake County 10 years ago instituted this policy of busing for socioeconomic diversity, I think that the county pretty much embraced it, because I think we were still at a time where the county itself was not very well distributed. And I think that over the course of this explosive growth that Mr. DeWitt is referring to, I think that has shifted. There have been several reports from the News and Observer here done over the years indicating that the diversity itself within neighborhoods across Wake County has balanced itself naturally. Now, that is not to say that there are not still high concentrations of poverty in Wake County. But what we found was that, as he indicated, with this growth, it was becoming more and more difficult for the school board to reach this 40% threshold. And as a result, they were doing a variety of things. They were converting schools to mandatory year-round schedules. You were having parents with children on multiple schedules being shipped to schools an hour away if they couldn't make that schedule work for them. And it became a tremendous disruption in the lives of families. And why we are going and address this was because if it is not all things that the school board do should be driven by raising the achievement of children. And Mr. DeWitt mentioned the graduation rate. That is just one of the statistics. I mean, individually within the schools, if you look at the numbers of passing rates for our end-of-course tests among economically disadvantaged children, they are not increasing.
Okay. Wait, Patrice, just one second real quick, because I looked, go to your very first point, I looked at some maps about distribution of both race and socioeconomic status, and they're stark. Your county is really not integrated. I mean, in terms of color, blacks are concentrated in one area, whites are concentrated in another, and socioeconomically, it's very divided. And that must be, that must be a concern for you, for your kids in school.
Well, I don't know that I completely agree with that. I think that there is clearly a large, there is a pocket within downtown Raleigh that does have a high African-American population and a high poverty population. There's no doubt about that. But the county as a whole, and you have to remember, we are a county-based system, not a district-based system like many of them up north. We do have a tremendous amount of diversity across the county.
Once you spread it out over the whole county, Patrice Lease is the director of Wake Cares, a parent advocacy group formed in Cary, North Carolina. Dave DeWitt is the education reporter at North Carolina Public Radio. Coming up, we're going to talk about food as we do every Wednesday, and we have a very sweet conversation in store. Are foods getting sweeter? Do we know where the sugar is in our food? We'll tell you why you should care in just a minute.
So for the next few moments, let's consider the poor predicament of the United States Postal Service. It's facing dire times, predicting it will lose $238 billion over the next 10 years. Yesterday, they cried out, proposing some changes that could save them, including having no deliveries on Saturday. Ed O'Keefe joins us now. He's the author of the Federal Eye blog on the Washington Post and a federal government reporter. Good morning, Ed.
Good morning.
So you really have to be sympathetic to the Postal Service. It's a government agency, but it's not tax-supported. And so the federal government dictates its service, but it can't really affect its revenues. And in an Internet environment, the Postal Service is looking at declining revenues. What's a mailman to do?
Well, the Postmaster General and his aides have proposed that they cut Saturday service. He wants more flexibility to raise prices beyond the rate of inflation, which, as you said, Congress doesn't let them do right now. Their hands are tied on that. They want to be able eventually to close up to as many as 10,000 post offices across the country and move a lot of those postal services and products into nearby supermarkets or coffee shops or office depots.
Turn them into sort of ATM-style services, right?
Not only just ATM, but also you may see supermarket or office depot employees actually sort of acting as postal clerks in some cases.
This really struck a chord with some of our listeners. Listen to what one listener asked about what this would mean if the Postal Service got rid of Saturday delivery.
This is John in Denver. I don't have any problem with the post office cutting back to 5 days a week. But my question is, does that mean that that's less junk mail I will get? Gosh, 70% of my mail is junk mail, and there's a lot of it.
So is junk mail a good thing for the Postal Service? It's bad there for John living out there in Denver.
There would be more junk mail.
More
junk
mail.
And the reason is that currently there's a pretty decent level of first-class mail, but the projections are that people will send less of it, and you'll see more standard mail, which is another way of saying sort of junk mail that advertisers and retailers and whatnot send to your home. But the way the Postal Service sees it, mail is mail is mail. And as long as people are sending it, they're happy, no matter what kind of mail it is.
Ed O'Keefe, is there any Internet business for the post office to get involved in to try to evolve them out of this predicament?
There is an option that they're going to explore a little further. In Europe, they have what's called hybrid mail products, where some of your mail is delivered via email in a very limited way. And the Postmaster General said they will seriously look at it, but it's a double-edged sword, because if you start to deliver too much of it that way, you're going to cut volume and revenue even further. At the same time, he said that it seems as if there is a way for them to provide some of that, and they've got to explore it.
And $3 billion savings if they cut Saturday delivery? Is that the idea?
Roughly. I mean, you're going to keep the postal trucks from running. You're going to save on gas. You're going to save on staffing. The problem is the two major labor unions that represent postal workers don't like the idea.
Indeed.
And they want them to explore other options. And there are lawmakers up on Capitol Hill who certainly don't want to rubber stamp this either.
All right, Ed O'Keefe, author of the Federal Eye blog on the Washington Post and a federal government reporter. Thanks so much.
Anytime.
The mail never stops. It just keeps coming and coming and coming. There's never a let up. It's relentless. Every day it piles up more and more and more. You've got to get it out. And the more you get out, the more it keeps coming in. And then the barcode reader breaks. And it's public. It's clearing out.
Good morning. I'm Celeste Headlee. I'm here with John Hockenberry. Coming up.
Too much sugar and too much cake. Up with a bellyache.
One could argue that Brian Wilson is not the best spokesman for a segment about cutting back on fattening foods.
Yeah, really disciplined guy there.
However, we are going to be talking about whether or not there's too much sugar in our foods in just a few moments. First, here's a check on leading stories at 47 minutes after the hour. When President Obama unveils his final health care package today, it'll include some Republican ideas, but that does not mean he'll win any new GOP support. Instead, Democrats are expected to push the package through Congress using the process called reconciliation. On NBC this morning, Democratic Party Chairman Tim Kaine says that process is pretty familiar to Republicans.
It has been used numerous times over the last two decades for major legislation, for health care legislation, for tax cuts that are much bigger than the financial impact of this bill. So these guys, they like it when they like it.
The president is expected to unveil his bill at 1:45 p.m. Eastern Time today. Also in politics, the Senate passed a $10 billion measure extending jobless benefits yesterday. President Obama signed the bill last night. It had been held up by Republican Senator Jim Bunning of Kentucky.
30 people in the Iraqi city of Bakuba died this morning when suicide bombers attacked. The attacks come as campaigning for Sunday's parliamentary elections continue. To get more, we spoke with Gabriel Gatehouse, correspondent for our partner, the BBC. He joined us from Baghdad, and we asked him if these bombings were tied to the campaign season.
I think some people will certainly see it that way. Many have been fearing that there'll be some kind of attack as polling day nears, and these certainly fit that bill, attacks on members of the security forces, and then, in fact, a third attack at a hospital as emergency services were bringing in the wounded.
Although, Gabriel, we've seen this again and again, I'm wondering if it's kind of ritualized and that the impact, the political impact and the turnout impact in Iraq is not expected to be as great as perhaps the insurgents might have anticipated.
What people are saying is that turnout, they expect it to be around 50%. That's not as high as they'd hoped, but it's not bad compared to some other countries. I think there is a fear that polling stations will be targeted on polling day itself. The authorities are mounting a massive security operation. In Baghdad alone, they're going to have 200,000 security personnel on duty just in the capital. So I think everyone's got their fingers crossed and hoping that the attackers won't be able to get through.
Gabriel Gatehouse, correspondent for our partner in the BBC, joined us earlier from Baghdad. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning. All you can eat. Well, I'ma stuff my face to a funky beat. We're gonna walk inside. And guess what's up?
Put the food on my plate. Add some coke in my cup. All you can eat. It's Wednesday and time to talk about food. And today we're gonna talk about sugar, sweet things, chocolate, candy bars, cookies.
This is news.
Brownies. No, you expect sugar to be in those things, right? You know when you're eating those things that you're eating sugar. But you're also eating sugar when you eat bread. You're also eating sugar when you eat Raisin Bran. People don't often realize how much sugar they eat every single day. So the question is, are sweets really that bad? To answer us, Dr. Brian Wansink is here. He's director of the Food and Brand Lab at Cornell, author of Mindless Eating. And he's also the former executive director of the USDA Dietary Guidelines, so he knows a few things about sweets. And Melissa Clark also joins us, food writer extraordinaire for our partner, The New York Times. She's going to talk to us about... Melissa. She reduced sugar recipes. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Oh, it's great to be with you this morning.
So, Dr. Wansink, tell me about sugar. How is it really bad for us?
Well, what makes sugar bad ends up being because when we eat it, we end up not eating something else we should eat. So, for instance, if we decide we're going to have four pixie sticks for breakfast, it's not the pixie sticks are going to kill us. What it is that we don't end up eating an orange, we don't end up eating an apple, we don't end up eating yogurt because we're full. So it's actually the calories that sugar preempts that ends up being probably the worst effect on our health.
Well, you know, I've been reading a lot about sugar and the ill effects of it, but I think one of the issues here, and you can maybe argue with me, Dr. Wansink, is that perhaps people don't realize how many things have sugar in them. Like you mentioned yogurt. Actually, most yogurts have a huge amount of sugar in them.
Yeah, there's a great rule of thumb, too, that the more colors there are on the packaged yogurt, the more sugar it's going to have in it.
That's
right. What's believed is that the typical person, I just got back from the American Heart Association meeting this morning at about 2:30 in the morning, and one of the things that they found is that about 355 calories of what we consume in a day. That's, you know, that's about 20% of what we eat is made up of these added sugars, and it comes in all sorts of weird forms. But it's believed that about half of that in our diet ends up mainly coming from soft drinks.
Wow. Okay, so Melissa, you, of course, are always encouraging people to get into the kitchen more and spend some quality time there. And your idea is that if we cooked our own food, we could avoid these added sugars.
Well, at least you have control over how much sugar you're adding. And that's, I think, really key. When you go out and you buy, for example, I brought this Oreo brownie bar for you guys to take a look at. And
it weighs like 6 pounds.
It's like a brick.
Well, and it's 6 pounds of pure sugar. If you look at the ingredients, sugar is listed. It's disguised, but it's listed about 6 times. There's sugar listed twice. There's high fructose corn syrup. There's regular corn syrup. There's fructose. There's a lot of sugar
in
this.
It's the backup sugar in case you don't get enough.
Then there's the chocolate. And then I made a blueberry muffin with maple syrup. There's no refined sugar. It's maple syrup is the only sweetener in that. And if you guys just want to
taste the Oreo bar first.
But the thing about cooking something at home is you're not going to add as much sugar because you don't have to. You're using real eggs, real butter, real flour. A little bit of sugar is all you need to make something taste delicious. Whereas if something is this processed, you're not starting with real food, so you have to add a lot of sugar and salt.
But could somebody help me out here? I was reading that even if you do use natural ingredients, there are some produce that has been genetically engineered to have more sugar in it, fruit and these sorts of things, and that our sense of tasting sweet has maybe evolved in the last generation, Dr. Wansink?
Yeah, to something, and it's hard to say that they're out there engineering food to be sweeter. You know, they're a lot smarter than that. They actually are probably engineering foods that is more disease resistant, so it has a longer shelf life. I mean, hybrid crops have been going on for a long, long time. But it's also true that regardless of what flavor it is or what taste it is, that we can adapt to increased levels of it. So just in the same way that if we put salt in all our food, we need more and more salt to get a kick out of it. The same thing happens with sugar, too. The more sugar we find in our foods, the more sugar we kind of want because we need this level of adaptation that we need to satisfy.
Excuse me, Doc. Have you tried both of these?
Yeah.
It's shocking.
It is
different.
Shocking. The Oreo brownie bar literally...
It's like a drug.
It is.
I'm dizzy.
And it's not even a real... It's not even a real taste. It doesn't even taste like a real...
Yeah,
like if you ask me what flavor that is, I couldn't even say chocolate. I don't
say
know.
Sugar. Exactly.
But the brownie the blueberry muffin actually tastes very sweet.
And that's all maple syrup. And the thing is, I mean, like Dr. Wansink was talking about, at least with maple syrup, the calories aren't completely empty. I mean, yes, they're not as good as more calories like whole wheat flour, but with maple syrup you're getting a lot of minerals, you're getting a lot of zinc, you're getting a lot of magnesium,
and
you're using a lot less because maple syrup is sweeter than sugar, so you can use less and it gives a great flavor. There's no flavoring in that except maple syrup. There's no vanilla extract. It's just all the ingredients themselves.
But here's the thing, and Dr. Wansink, maybe you can answer this because you helped to construct the dietary guidelines. People are busier now than they ever have been, and so picking up an Oreo brownie bar as distasteful as it is, and maybe as much sugar as it is, that's much faster than making a blueberry muffin.
It is. And if we're a bad cook, the easiest way to be a better cook is to add more sugar to it, unfortunately.
That's a very good point. But, I mean, the thing about baking something yourself, another thing about baking, if you say, I'm only going to eat sweets that I make myself, I mean, chances are you're not going to eat that many sweets because it does take it takes longer to buy one, longer to make
it's
one at home.
That's a great strategy.
I know.
There's the takeaway from Melissa.
I know. Just only eat sweets you make yourself. They taste better.
For a lot of people, they would stop eating sweets altogether.
Exactly.
Melissa's words to live by.
Melissa Clark is a food writer for our partner, the New York Times. And Dr. Brian Wansink, professor and director of the Food and Brand Lab at Cornell, also author of Mindless Eating.
Mindless Eating. I never do anything like that. If you're looking for a less sugary alternative for breakfast, you can get Melissa Clark's recipe for maple blueberry muffins at our website, thetakeaway.org. Just click on today's show. While you're at our site, you can learn more about a project by our partner, the BBC. They're hosting a competition to have people show off my world to the rest of the globe. How is your world special and unique? We'll talk about it later this morning, but tell us, what's the one thing you would want people around the world to know about you? Take part by calling 877-8-MY-TAKE. Find out more by going to our website, thetakeaway.org. And while you're at our site,
The only complaint about the dog show we held on this show recently was about cats. Why couldn't people send in their cat photos? Calling all cat
Didn't
owners
see that
now.
Coming.
Send us your photos on our Facebook page, and we'll have our listeners vote on their favorite little kitty. Find out how to do it at thetakeaway.org. I'm Jordan Hockenberry.
And no fair dressing your dog up like a cat. I'm Celeste Headlee, and this is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to The Takeaway Podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.